From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! The New York Police Department carried out an extensive national and international spying operation on protesters leading up to the 2004 Republican convention. The RNC Intelligence Squad sent undercover officers posing as activists to infiltrate political groups. We'll speak with the New York Times reporter who broke the story, the NYPD, a civil liberties attorney, and an activist who was the subject of four pages of surveillance records. Then British Prime Minister Tony Blair demands the release of 15 British sailors and Marines captured by Iran on Friday in the Persian Gulf.
This is a very serious situation, and there is no doubt at all that these people were taken from a boat in Iraqi water. It simply is not true that they went into Iranian territorial waters.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the House voted Friday to give President Bush $100 billion more for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while requiring combat troops be withdrawn from Iraq by September 2008. The vote was 218 to 212. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Proudly, this new Congress voted to bring an end to the war in Iraq. It took one great giant step in that direction. It voted no to giving a blank check to an open-ended commitment to war without end to the President of the United States, and yes, to begin the end of the war and the redeployment of our troops.
On Saturday, Vice President Dick Cheney lashed out at House Democrats. Cheney said, quote, "They're not supporting the troops. They're undermining them." President Bush has vowed to veto the legislation if it reaches his desk.
The purpose of the emergency war spending bill I requested was to provide our troops with vital funding. Instead, Democrats in the House, in an act of political theater, voted to substitute their judgment for that of our military commanders on the ground in Iraq. They set rigid restrictions that require an army of lawyers to interpret.
A total of 14 Democrats voted against the bill, including 8 who oppose any more funding of the war. The 8 anti-war Democrats were Maxine Waters, Lynn Woolsey, Diane Watson, and Barbara Lee, all from California, Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, John Lewis of Georgia, Mike McNulty of New York, and Mike Michaud of Maine. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi managed to secure passage of the spending bill because she received the support of many Democrats who'd voted against previous supplemental spending measures. The Senate's taking up a similar spending bill this week. In news from Iraq, the New York Times is reporting U.S. Ambassador Zamir Khalilzad held secret talks last year with Sunni militants. He's the first American official to publicly acknowledge holding such talks. Included in the discussions were self-identified representatives of the Islamic Army of Iraq and the 1920 Revolution Brigades. Khalilzad declined to give details on the meetings. In other news from the region, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Salam al-Zubayi has undergone surgery for stomach and shoulder wounds. He was injured Friday in a suicide bombing near his house. The bomber was reportedly a distant relative of his. The British government is demanding Iran release 15 British sailors and Marines captured by Iran Friday in the Persian Gulf. Iran says the 14 men and one woman were seized after crossing into Iranian waters to search an Indian vessel. British Prime Minister Tony Blair rejected Iran's claim.
This is a very serious situation, and there is no doubt at all that these people were taken from a boat in Iraqi water. It simply is not true that they went into Iranian territorial waters.
Iran says the sailors could be charged with illegally entering Iranian waters. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has unanimously approved new sanctions against Iran for refusing to suspend its uranium enrichment program. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad denounced these sanctions and said Iran would limit cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog agency. The New York Times has revealed undercover New York City police officers traveled around the country, Canada, and Europe to spy on protesters planning to attend the 2004 Republican National Convention. The city set up an RNC intelligence squad and sent undercover officers to attend meetings of political groups posing as sympathizers or fellow activists. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Canadian pet food company Menu Foods has expanded its recall of tainted cat and dog food that's killed at least 14 pets. The company said store owners should remove all of its wet food products regardless of the production date because some of the food is tainted with rat poison. The company manufactures and distributes more than 90 brands of pet food. A complete list can be found at menufoods.com. Newly released Justice Department documents show Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez indicates he lied about his involvement in the recent dismissals of eight U.S. attorneys. 2 weeks ago, Gonzalez said, quote, "I was not involved in seeing any memos and was not involved in any discussion about what was going on." However, the documents reveal that on November 27th, Gonzalez met with five other officials from the Justice Department and signed off on a plan to fire the prosecutors. President Bush's former Deputy Secretary of the Interior, Stephen Growls, has pled guilty to lying about his relationship with Republican Jack Abramoff. Growls is the highest-ranking Bush administration official convicted in the Abramoff lobbying scandal. Abramoff's clients paid more than $500,000 to a nonprofit environmental group that he ran, Growls' girlfriend ran, Talia Federici, who was a former aide to then-Secretary of the Interior, Gail Norton. Growls could have faced up to a five-year prison term, but federal prosecutors said they'll only recommend a 10-month sentence. Meanwhile, federal prosecutors are recommending Jack Abramoff's prison sentence be reduced. He's scheduled for release in 2011, but prosecutors are pushing for an earlier release because he's cooperating with investigators. A new ABC News Washington Post poll has found a record 64% of the country now believe the Iraq War was not worth fighting. The same poll put President Bush's approval rating at just 36%. Bush hasn't had a majority approval in more than 2 years, the longest run without majority support for any president since Harry Truman in the early 1950s. The Washington Post is reporting the size of the government database on terrorism suspects has quadrupled in size over the past 4 years. Each day, thousands of pieces of intelligence information from around the world are fed into the database known as TIDE, for Terrorist Identities Data Environment. This includes field reports, captured documents, news from foreign allies, and sometimes idle gossip. The database is used to decide what names to put on watch lists and no-fly lists. This marks the first time foreigners and U.S. citizens are combined in an intelligence database. The bar for inclusion is low, and once someone's on the list, it's virtually impossible to get off it. Ban Ki-moon visited the West Bank Saturday for the first time since he became Secretary General of the United Nations. He met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and toured a Palestinian refugee camp. He also criticized Israel for building a 450-mile wall through the West Bank.
This is a very sad and tragic to see many people suffering from this construction of walls, depriving opportunities for living, basic living, and education and health services.
Ban Ki-moon's visit to the West Bank came just days after a UN human rights envoy likened Israel's treatment of Palestinians to apartheid. The South African attorney, John Dugard, said restrictions on movement and separate residential areas gave a sense of deja vu to anyone with experience of apartheid in South Africa. Here in this country, jailed Palestinian professor Sami Alarian has ended his 60-day hunger strike at the urging of his family. Over the past 2 months, Alarian lost 53 pounds and became too weak to walk. Alarian remains in jail despite a jury's failure over a year ago to return a single guilty verdict on any of the 17 charges brought against him. The U.S. government had accused him of being a leader of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He eventually signed a plea deal with the government in exchange for being released and deported. He was scheduled to be released in April, but in January, a judge sentenced him to an additional 18 months in jail for refusing to testify before a Virginia grand jury. On Friday, a federal appeals court affirmed the judge's decision. In Northern Ireland, the main Protestant and Catholic parties have agreed to set up an historic power-sharing government in the province on May 8th. The announcement came after an unprecedented face-to-face meeting between Ian Paisley, the hardline leader of the Protestant Democratic Unionist Party, and Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin. In news from Africa, The Guardian reports Western governments are working to split Zimbabwe's ruling party in an attempt to topple Robert Mugabe's government. European and U.S. officials have been meeting with Zimbabwe's former army chief, Solomon Majuru, who's part of Mugabe's ZANU-PF ruling party. According to The Guardian, Majuru's emissaries have been in talks with the main faction of the opposition movement for democratic change. They're talking about creating an interim power-sharing government that would sideline Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe since it became independent in 1980. On Friday, Mugabe vowed to survive any Western attempt to dislodge him from power.
Nothing frightens me. I'm an Akanyora Kuteli, he's a frightened man. I'm being frightened by who? Little fellows like Vanna Bush and Blair. Never. I have seen it all. And I don't fear any suffering, any bitter struggle of any kind.
Pressure on Mugabe is also being applied within the religious community in Zimbabwe. Last week, Roman Catholic Archbishop Pius Nwumbi called for massive protests against the government.
Human rights are God-given, and the government is our property. They ought to be answerable to us, not that they control us and hold us so tight.
It's an opportunity.
On Sunday, Africans marked the 200th anniversary of Britain's abolition of the transatlantic slave trade at a ceremony at a former slave fort in Ghana. Elmina was sub-Saharan Africa's first permanent slave trading post. South African musician Hugh Masekela spoke at the ceremony.
If you look at Africans all over the world, in any society, whether it's Brazil, Colombia, the United States, the Caribbean, we live in squalor. So the state of slavery from a dungeon point of view hasn't changed, you know, and it's very important for us to realize that the impact of slavery hasn't changed. If anything, it's getting worse.
Meanwhile, thousands of people marched in London Saturday to mark the anniversary as well. Prime Minister Tony Blair released a statement by video, but declined to give a formal apology for Britain's role in the slave trade.
It's an opportunity also for the United Kingdom to express our deep sorrow and regret for our nation's role in the slave trade and for the unbearable suffering, individually and collectively, that it caused.
While Britain ended its role in the slave trade in 1807, slavery remained legal in the United States for another six decades. The city commissioners of Largo, Florida, have voted to fire Largo's city manager, Steve Stanton, a month after it was revealed he's a transsexual and that he plans to live as a woman and eventually pursue a sex change operation. On Friday night, hundreds of supporters of Stanton gathered in Largo to urge the city commissioners to reconsider. Members of Equality Florida wore pink T-shirts that read, "Don't discriminate." Stanton had served as Largo's city manager for 14 years. City commissioners claimed the vote was because of his management style, not his lifestyle. Protests are continuing across the country against the war in Iraq. In Sacramento, seven activists were arrested Thursday in the office of Democratic Congressmember Doris Matsui as they attempted to read the names of people killed during the Iraq war and occupation. The activists had all taken part in a 52-day peace-in at Matsui's office. The action began January 8th, ended on Thursday. The protest has been described as the longest occupation of a congressional office in U.S. history. In New York, police arrested five members of Peace Action Staten Island Friday while they were occupying the office of Republican Congressmember Vito Fisella. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Satellites over my head. head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss, may I have your phone number and your social security? Who, me? When all I came to do was buy my double or triple A batteries, please, I decline.
Jill Scott watching me here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new expose has revealed the New York City Police Department carried out an extensive national and international spying operation on protesters leading up to the Republican National Convention in 2004. On Sunday, the New York Times reported teams of undercover officers were sent across the country to Canada and to Europe to spy on groups and individuals planning to take part in the protests here in New York. The officers were part of what was called the RNC Intelligence Squad. Squad members posed as activists and filed daily intelligence reports on their activities. Some of the targets included street theater companies, church groups, anti-war organizations, environmentalists, musical artists, and death penalty opponents. The intelligence was shared with police departments nationwide. Today, we'll hear from the New York Police Department, a civil liberties attorney, and an activist who is subject to four pages of surveillance records. But first, I'm joined by the reporter who broke the story for the New York Times. Jim Dwyer joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning.
Jim, lay it out for us.
Okay. In 2003, New York City found out it was going to be the host of the RNC, the Republican National Convention, in late August 2004. And part of their preparations included using the intelligence division to collect information about who was coming to the city to protest.
And who is the intelligence department?
Well, the intelligence division is a shifting body. It's a group that part of the police department that was expanded significantly after 9/11, when Commissioner Ray Kelly came in office. There were a lot of revelations about the national intelligence system being very threadbare and creaking and unable to communicate from the FBI to one branch of the FBI to another. And so Kelly decided that the city needed its own intelligence capability, and he actually brought in a deputy commissioner from the CIA, a guy named David Cohen, to head up that effort. The other thing that happened was the city began to take steps to loosen the restrictions that had been on surveillance of political groups as a result of a class action lawsuit that was brought over a prior generation of a prior iteration of the intelligence division. And that lawsuit had been filed back in 1971, and the restrictions were still in place. And they were guidelines under which that said what circumstances the police could monitor political activity. And so in late 2002 and going into 2003, they sought to ease those restrictions. They're simultaneously expanding the capacity of the intelligence division so that the city is more self-sufficient, I guess you would say, and when they got the convention, it was right around the time that these rules from this class action lawsuit, which are known as the handshoe guidelines, were substantially eased. And so the city basically set out to collect a lot of information with this newly muscular organization that was set up as a counterterrorism tool. But it became sort of a logistics and political protest assessment tool as well. It was seemed like a somewhat different function than it had really been set up for.
Explain how New York then related to the rest of the country.
Yeah. Well, New York was viewed by the police department as, and correctly, as a place that a lot of people were going to come to express their views during the convention. And so the city sent out detectives to more than a dozen states. They probably were in every major city in the country. And the undercover agents would pose as activists or sympathizers and, basically infiltrate these groups to some extent. And for how long, it's not entirely clear. How disruptive this infiltration was, we really don't know, or if it was disruptive. But we do know that these detectives were sent all over the country. They went to Canada, they went to Europe in some cases, and they filed reports back, and these reports were compiled into weekly digests. And there was even a classification system set up. I think it was a little bit fanciful, but it was called NYPD Secret. I don't think that has any particular meaning in law, but it was something that was set up to handle the documents that came in for the RNC.
They would be stamped NYPD Secret.
They were stamped NYPD Secret.
You write that police records indicate, in addition to sharing information with other police departments, New York undercover officers were actually active themselves in at least 15 places outside New York, including California, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montreal, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, and Washington, D.C., not to mention Europe.
Yes, and, of course, the five boroughs of New York. Yeah, this NYPD went all over the place, and the reason they did, the police say, is to get an idea of how many people were going to be coming and what their intentions were about how they would act when they got to New York.
Now, this is serious when you talk about infiltration, because you can also talk about provocateurs.
I don't know anything about provocateurs. I mean, I didn't report anything about that, and I don't know anything to that effect.
But that's what it can lead to.
Right, yeah. It's classified as... in the NYPD guidelines, undercover agents are classified as an intrusive tactic, and the guidelines are meant to reflect that this is a very sensitive and powerful tool, particularly in the context of political investigations. And so when the NYPD applied for this easing of the restrictions in 2002 and 2003, Mr. Cohen and others said, look, we're going to be careful about how we use this authority, and we're going to be, stringent and, well, I don't want to say that word stringent, but we're going to apply a series of reviews to make sure that it's only applied in the appropriate circumstances. And what are the appropriate circumstances? According to the guidelines and according to Judge Charles Haight, who oversees that case, there has to be some indication of unlawful activity for the police to launch an inquiry.
We're talking to Jim Dwyer of the New York Times. You wrote a piece today that says the police say the documents should remain secret so the news media will not, quote, fixate upon and sensationalizing them, hurting the city's ability to defend itself in lawsuits over mass arrests.
Well, actually, the NYPD didn't say that. I didn't say it. No, the city lawyer said it. So the city legal department made that assertion. The Times and the Civil Liberties Union separately are seeking to unseal these documents. And I understand the Civil Liberties Union is also seeking additional material now as well. They're seeking some of the raw intelligence documents that underlay the digest. What happened in the RNC cases, there's a whole bunch of lawsuits going forward over the people who were arrested during the convention. And as part of that, earlier this year, the city turned over to the plaintiffs a big pile of the Daily Digest, or the Weekly Digest, as the case was. And now the Civil Liberties Union is seeking the underlying raw materials, the detective reports from the fields that made up those Daily Digests. On a separate track, the Times has asked the judge to unseal the material that already has been turned over. The Civil Liberties Union is also asking for that material to be turned unsealed.
The organizations, Jim Dwyer, that were surveilled, you talk about, for example, the War Resisters League.
Yeah.
What else? What other groups?
Well,
environmental groups.
Billionaires for Bush was one.
Billionaires for Bush being the comic troupe.
Yes, Billionaires for Bush are not really Billionaires for Bush. I just got one of our photo editors was looking, was trying to understand the. I sent in an assignment saying we need a picture of this guy from Billionaires for Bush, and she said, "Why is there a group called?" Doesn't everybody assume? and anyway, we straightened that out. The Billionaires for Bush are a bunch of people who wear bow ties and tuxedos, and they go around with martini glasses and pretend to be supporters of the Bush administration. In fact, they issued a statement yesterday saying that they suspected they were under surveillance because the police were looking for stock tips from them. Billionaires for Bush... there were city councilmen who were listed in the reports because they were endorsing various press conferences or demonstrations.
You have the sponsors an event planned for January 15, 2004, in honor of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, were listed in one of the reports, which noted that it was a protest against, quote, the RNC, the war in Iraq, and the Bush administration mentioned three members of the New York City Council at the time, Charles Barron, Bill Perkins, and Larry B. Seabrook, who, quote, have endorsed this event.
Yes. Now, the NYPD also, although I have not seen these materials, but the NYPD says that it was also surveilling people with histories of violent acts. There's a man who had a series of convictions for bombings back in the 70s who they say they were tracking. There were individuals they said had records of violence in during other protests in Seattle, Genoa, and other places, who they were, who they say they were watching as well. I haven't seen the materials about those surveillance.
How did you get all of this information?
I was born on third base and thought I hit a triple, to quote Ann Richards. I've been reporting on this for a while, and a number of people. Thought it was important that I see it.
The other time that we had you on, Jim Dwyer, was on the issue of critical mass and the cyclists that rode through the city and mm-hmm. the undercover surveillance of them. Did they fit into this story, critical mass?
Yes, critical mass and Time's Up, there were reports on both of those groups on their plans for various, that there was going to be a ride a big ride before the convention, and also that the ride was expanding. I remember reading about that in some of those materials. And Time's Up, which is associated with Critical Mass, was having a retreat or some kind of planning conference ahead of the convention, and that was described in some of the reports. There was a march from, you're sort of jogging my memory now, so I can remember a couple other things. There was a march by a group of families who lost people in the 9/11 attacks, who were rolling a memorial block of granite, I think, from Boston down to New York. But it was some kind of march like that, and they said it was in commemoration of civilians who had been killed in wars throughout time. That there was a report on them. There was a march from Boston to New York. I think it was RNC to DNC. That was, you know, included in the reports. There were groups that were planning civil disobedience in Syracuse that was planning to step off the curb, step off curbs around Madison Square Garden where the convention was going to be held at a certain time. There was a report about that.
And the problem with there being a report about each of these things?
Well, I'm not saying there was a problem about it. I'm just telling you there were reports. That's up for other people to decide whether it's a problem or not.
Well, in our next segment, we will have a discussion, a debate between New York Civil Liberties Union. One of the people who you talked about, Joshua Kinberg, will be joining us in San Francisco. Why don't you give us a preview of who he is?
Joshua Kinberg was a graduate student at Parsons School of Design, and he devised this bicycle. I have to say, it was just fabulous. It was like an earthbound skyrider. And on the back of the bicycle, he had rigged up something that could squirt chalk, dots and dashes of chalk, so that as he went along on the street, he could print a message out. To add to the kind of drama of the thing, he had a laptop and a cell phone, and all of these things would work together. People would send in messages to his website, and they would get printed out through his chalk machine. And the thing actually worked, which is hard to believe. He was, you know, they had several pages of material about him. There were a couple pages of pictures of the bicycle and the gadget, and it said that, you know, the sole purpose is protesting at the RNC and to print what they called activist-type messages on the street, and then he could make a fast getaway. But one of the intelligence reports noted that he was using water-soluble chalk rather than paint to avoid a criminal mischief charge. And there was other groups that were, you know, it's hard to know why, in some cases, the government had any interest in some of these people. There was a thing called Bands Against Bush, and they were having a series of concerts around the country on a particular day in October 2003. And there were going to be political videos in between the musical sets. And for some reason, this became a matter of interest to the intelligence division, and they decided to notify the police. I think it was in Seattle, Washington, San Francisco, Chicago, maybe a couple other cities like that.
And were you able to gather all the different ways that they gathered the information?
No, I don't think you could see from the documents.
Yeah,
I mean, I think we don't know a lot about this process yet. I mean, we had a very long article in the newspaper, but in some ways, it's very schematic. You know, we're talking about the map of a fairly large and significant operation, and there's probably a lot of important things that we don't know about it. And, you know, I think there's probably things that the police department feels proud about, that they feel were accomplishments and they prevented crimes and things that we don't know about yet, or maybe there aren't. I don't know what the answer is to that, but so far we're only seeing, you know, the first glimpses of this operation.
Well, Jim Dwyer, thanks very much for this expose. We are going to follow up in our next segment with a debate between the police department and civil liberties lawyer and Joshua Kinberg himself, the man on the bicycle, who only got it returned after a year. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Jim Dwyer of the New York Times. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone, and I always feel like somebody's.
Somebody is watching me. Rockwell here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country on NPR and Pacifica and low-power FM and college and community stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're on Public Access TV and PBS TV stations, and we video and audio podcast at democracynow.org. As we continue this discussion about surveillance, the New York Times expose, New York police infiltrated groups planning protests at the GOP convention of 2004. We're joined by three guests. Paul Brown is on the line with us, the New York City Police Department's Deputy Commissioner of Public Information. Here in our firehouse studio, civil rights attorney Jethro Eisenstein. Since 1971, he's been a co-counsel on the Hanshu case, which has resulted in putting limits on how the police carry out political investigations. And in San Francisco, we are joined by Joshua Kinberg, who was one of the targets of the investigations. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let's begin with Paul Brown. Can you give your response to the New York Times expose on this level of surveillance before the 2004 Republican convention?
Well, there's a couple of things I just want to correct. One, we were not sharing information with other police intelligence agencies around the country. I think that's how you opened it up. And the list was not quite as extensive as the Times reported of states and countries, et cetera. However, that's sort of besides the point. We were not engaged in the business of spying on lawful activity, which is sort of the implication of certainly what the New York Civil Liberties Union is saying. We were concerned about relatively small groups, some of them embedded in bigger ones, but around the country, coming to New York with plans to try to stop delegates from getting to the convention, to disable their buses, to brick and bomb was their terms, certain locations like Starbucks and McDonald's. And we took the appropriate action to gain information about them. These listing of other groups, mentions of other groups, some of the things that haven't been mentioned was the U.S. Open, the Yankees home game. Anything that had to do with the convention that was going to have an impact on police resources was reported every day as we got closer to the convention. That wasn't an intelligence operation. That was just a matter of apprising the department of everything. You know, if a city council was calling for the change of the venue, which they did, for example, of changing that if certain things weren't done, the Republicans shouldn't be allowed to have the convention in New York. That was noted, but this wasn't a matter of spying. This was simply a matter of keeping the department informed. A lot of this was taken from websites and just newspaper articles, et cetera. It wasn't a matter of having somebody spying on a legitimate activity.
What about organizations like, for example, Billionaires for Bush,
well,
the
exactly
War Resisters
exactly
League?
The same thing. That's exactly the same thing. People who there's lists. What the Times article is referring to is just daily lists of just activities. And like I said, some of them might be the opening of the U.S. Open tennis matches, in addition to the fact that there's going to be a demonstration or an event associated with. They're not all sinister group, and we're not implying that, and we weren't spying on them.
And the stamp that says NYPD secret?
Sorry?
The stamp that says NYPD secret on these documents?
Well, I haven't seen the documents that say that. I don't know what he's referring to, but there may be some. There was some, I mean, certainly sensitive information, but ultimately public because they came from criminal records. One of the things Jim Dwyer mentioned was we were concerned about certain individuals, and he mentioned one of them, Richard Piccirillo. His political views were that the U.S. was imperialistic and oppressive, and in the past, in the late 1978, he was sentenced for his role in blowing up a plane at Logan Airport in connection with his political views. He also blew up two National Guard trucks at the Dorchester Armory in Massachusetts, and bombed the Essex Superior Courthouse in Newburyport in Massachusetts. And then he fled to Canada, and when he returned, he bombed a power plant in Maine. That was somebody we were concerned about. And although he might be meeting in Massachusetts with others who were not engaged in or had intentions of engaging in violent activity, his past certainly concerned us, and his intention on coming into New York rightfully concerned the police department.
Jethro Eisenstein of the New York Civil Liberties Union, your response.
Well, first, full disclosure, I'm not of the New York Civil Liberties Union. I'm one of the lawyers who brought the Handshoe case that created the set of rules that governs police surveillance of political activities. The body of information that I can respond about is what Jim Dwyer has reported. And what Jim Dwyer has reported is that over and over again, the police department went out to organizations that gave no indication of being interested in illegal activity, instead gave indication of being of intending to participate in protest activity around the convention, and continued to surveil those organizations, infiltrate them with undercover officers, and send reports about them. And that's the, Commissioner Brown can, I'm sure, legitimately point to one or more, maybe several, situations where investigations were legitimately based on people about whom the police department had reason to think that they could be involved in illegal activity. But that doesn't really respond to the fact that the reporting in the New York Times suggests that there was widespread surveillance and report writing and dossier generating about people who were involved in no such illegal activities.
No, I did respond to that. I said a lot of what is described as infiltration or surveillance was, in fact, just lists of activities, like I said, that were going to have an impact in New York. Whether that was the U.S. Open having its tennis matches in New York, or an unusual circumstance where you had the Yankees and the Mets having a home game in the same week. It doesn't usually happen. It was our luck that it was going to happen during the week of the RNC. So there was all sorts of things noted. This wasn't a matter of we weren't infiltrating the U.S. Open in noting the fact that they were going to there were going to be activities here associated with that. And there were a host of RNC-related activities that we cited, but we were not investigating for illegal activity.
I'm sure that what Commissioner Brown says is true, but it still is not responding to what I'm talking about.
Well, I am responding. I'm saying where there was a concern of illegal activity. For example, there were groups out of state that were conducting courses on how to disable buses with the aim of disabling the delegate buses on their way to convention. There were groups that were planning to go in and prevent delegates from leaving their hotels, physically preventing them. There were others that were talking about smashing the windows of Starbucks and McDonald's. There were some using tactics, ball bearings and slingshots and others to use against the horses, mounted police, were we to use mounted police. All of that is a legitimate concern to the police department, and we investigated that.
And so how did you deal with other police departments in investigating that, since they were, as you said, outside of the city?
Well, we usually were in phone contact with them.
With other police departments.
Right.
And
but
so you share information
not,
you would have.
I think what you said initially was that we took all this information and gave it to other police departments. That's not correct.
Looking at the Jim Dwyer's piece, from Albuquerque to Montreal, San Francisco to Miami, undercover New York police officers attended meetings of political groups posing as sympathizers or fellow activists, the records show. He was looking at police documents.
Yeah, so what's the question?
So he was saying that...
Well, some of those locations are incorrect, but many of them are correct.
I think that the New York Times would not have written a front page story about a body of documents that showed that the police were time after time targeting organizations that were involved in illegal activity or planning it. The point of the story, the reason why it is newsworthy, is that the story reports, and Dwyer in particular reports, that over and over again, the police reports of undercover activity relate to organizations that are not involved in training to disable buses.
Well, I can tell you, may I finish, please? There were groups who are not involved in illegal activity as a group, but had individuals in them who were planning illegal activity.
Well, and there were also groups, according to Dwyer's reporting, in which no one was involved and no one was planning that. And what was reported by the undercover was that they were renting buses, consulting bus schedules, giving first aid training, trying to figure out how to deal with the logistics of getting large numbers of people for peaceful protest in New York City. And may I also say that under the rules that the police department insisted on jettisoning in 2002, there was a very open procedure if the police department was interested in logistics issues. It was called an event planning inquiry, and it allowed the police department to call organizations. Can I finish, please? It allowed the police department to determine information in an open and above board way, not by using undercovers.
Well, we do obtain information on logistics in an above board way and not using undercovers. That's my point.
Let me bring Joshua Kimberg into the conversation. He was arrested at the 2004 RNC protest for his project Bikes Against Bush, monitored by police in the lead-up to the protest. Joshua, explain your experience as you talk to us from a studio in San Francisco.
Sure. First of all, I wasn't actually arrested at any protest at all. I was actually arrested 2 days before the Republican National Convention, while giving an interview on the street to with Ron Reagan from MSNBC on the Hardball program. So I was actually arrested on television, on camera, while giving an interview and actually not protesting at all. And my project had to dealt with a piece of technology, a bicycle that could print chalk text messages on the street submitted by people online or through cell phone text messages.
First, the MSNBC Hardball interview. The picture is in the New York Times of you being arrested as Ron Reagan was interviewing you. But explain your bicycle and what happened to it and you.
Okay. The bicycle project, Bikes Against Bush, was also part of my graduate thesis. It was also an art performance piece that I had also earned an artist grant to create. Partially. And it was technology that I built. It was all very well documented online. It was all very public. It had been reported on extensively. What's troubling to me is the fact that it was considered a threat and systematically prevented, and thus my very lawful and artistic activity of free speech, and those who wish to participate in my project and exercise their free speech were systematically denied that opportunity.
Commissioner Brown, could you respond to what Joshua is saying?
Really, I can't. I don't know who the young man is or why he was arrested. I just read it as you did in the paper.
Explain, Joshua, and then what happened to your bicycle.
All my equipment, computer, cell phone, electronic equipment and bicycle was taken and was held for a year. Every charges against me were dropped 6 months later, but the equipment was held longer for unknown reasons, and I was unable to retrieve my equipment. Some of the equipment was never retrieved, the bicycle, for instance. Some of the equipment was partially damaged. I received a significant portion of the equipment a year after everything happened.
Joshua Eisenstein, Jethro, not to confuse you with Joshua. The issue of Hanshew and how it fits into the story, and especially for listeners and viewers around the country who are taking this in right now, what Hanshew means and what the most recent ruling means for police activity.
Which shall I answer? How did it start or the most recent?
Give us a synopsis.
Okay. in the late 1960s and early 1970s concerned about widespread police surveillance of political activities. I and the Civil Liberties Union and other lawyers brought a lawsuit, which is called Hanshu versus the police department, complaining about a whole raft of activities against political activists. To fast forward, in 1980, the city agreed to a settlement with us, and the settlement took the form of a set of rules that struck a balance between the needs of law enforcement and the rights of people to engage in political activity without being subject to police surveillance. Those rules were in place and effective from 1985 until 2002, when the police department came in to court and claimed, on the basis of the threat of terrorism in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, that they could not live with the rules, that they were too restrictive. They obtained a significant loosening of the rules, and it's important to note that they initially sought the elimination of the rules. And the judge, because of a constitutional doctrine that's involved in consent judgments like that, gave a very strong indication that he was not going to agree to a complete abolition of the rules. So at the very last minute, they came in with a set of rules that were based on the FBI guidelines, and they said that if the judge would permit the lifting or the loosening of the rules, they would put in place these FBI guidelines. And the battle then, the judge agreed to what they had done, and agreed to what they had done based on the threat of terrorism. And we take the position that what happened thereafter is that what was put in place, a loosening that was put in place because of the threat of terrorism, was employed not against terrorism, or we don't know whether it was, but was also employed widely against political dissent, political activity. And that became clear in early 2003 when the police started debriefing, they used that word, everyone who had been arrested for disorderly conduct about a whole raft of, with a whole raft of questions about their political beliefs, their political associations, their political views. What did they think about Israel and Palestine? Had they voted for Bush? Had they voted against Bush? What organizations did they belong to? We went back into the judge who had loosened the rules, and he then agreed to tighten them up somewhat. And what we've been fighting about ever since is exactly how tight they are. And the ruling that the judge made in February of this year was that the FBI rules that had been put in place are, in fact, binding rules that the police department must obey, and that the people involved in the lawsuit can come into court and complain about violations of these rules. Because the police department was taking the position that although the rules existed, they weren't binding, and no one could enforce them. So what's happened now is that they are enforceable.
Commissioner Brown, will the police department make these documents public?
Well, that's an issue for the city lawyers, really, to comment on, and it's being litigated now. Let me make one, I think, overarching point, which is sort of missed or is rarely mentioned when they talk about the police department and the RNC, and that is that we worked very, very hard to accommodate what the Times also described as the largest political protest in the history of American political conventions. We worked to accommodate 800,000 peaceful protesters, and we said repeatedly we anticipated they'd be peaceful during the RNC, and we're proud of our role in that. We also worked very hard to stop a small group, and in the end, the arrests in the RNC represented less than 0.5% of those who participated in demonstrations against the RNC. We worked very hard to prevent those who had plans to create violence, vandalism, or simply to stop delegates from attending the convention. And I think we did both successfully and within the law.
And the number of arrests we're talking about, I think it was around 1,800 arrests in the lead up to during that week.
Yeah, and you probably had, during the course of the week, a million protesters. You certainly had 800,000 on on August 29th. And then those who were unhappy, they felt that the United for Peace and Justice kind of sold out because they were peaceful and didn't try to shut down the convention. They began their activities on the 31st, which involved some of the things I described, trying to prevent delegates from getting to the convention, stopping them in their lobbies or on their buses, et cetera. The only serious injury, by the way, during the whole convention was to a police officer pulled from a scooter and kicked unconscious by a protester. The police showed remarkable restraint throughout, and the city functioned, the convention went forward, and you had the largest demonstration in the history of political conventions go off very well.
The ruling that, or the findings that of these 1,800 people who arrested, most were held far longer than most people would have been held for similar charges, with the belief that they were being held until President Bush spoke here in New York to stop the protest.
That's an absolute, that's the big lie that keeps getting repeated, that we held people for political reasons. What happened was you had a lot of arrests and a concentrated people. Concentrated period of time, over 1,000, that's right, when normally you might have 100 or so in the city arrested during that time. You also had individuals who would show no identification, which purposely slow the arrest process to try to keep the system kind of gummed up, and to a certain extent that worked. But the notion that that this was done for political reasons is the big lie that keeps getting repeated, but no matter how many times it gets repeated, it does not make it true.
Jethro Eisenstein, your response, and your response to the arrests and what is happening now.
Well, the my response about the arrest can only be anecdotal because I really have I have only one case of a person who was arrested, and while not directly responsive, let me simply say that this person was involved in a critical mass ride the Friday before the convention began, and with no warning, everyone, the case has now been settled by the city. With no warning, everybody in a one-street area was simply penned in. Everyone was arrested. These were all people who gave identification. They were all held for 24 hours when they could have all been released from a police precinct or from the pier where they were held. Instead, they were taken through the system and held much longer. And I always saw it, but this is only my personal opinion, as a sort of a dry run for large-scale arrests of people without individual attention, simply taking a block of people and blocking them all up, and then holding them for longer periods of time than were necessary. Certainly when I was down in court during that time, there was the courts were ready, the lawyers were ready, every part of the system was there except the police department. Police department was not producing, we say, bodies to get them arraigned and get them out.
Jethro Eisenstein, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much to Commissioner Paul Brown of the New York Police Department and to Jethro, as well as to Joshua Kineberg, the cyclist. That does it for our broadcast. Our website's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shuham Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Jen Utes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.